Today we're happy to have Harry Goodhill from Cambridge working in the group of Enrico Pagger. So Harry is visiting here for today and tomorrow, so you can feel free to interact with him. And today he will tell us about his recent work. Please go ahead.
Part of this talk is cutting cosmological correlators. I will get to the cutting bit sort of towards the end of the talk, and most days going to function as sort of an introduction to the idea of the cosmological bootstrap.
Oh, by the way, Harry, you don't need to, you can put off the mask.
Okay.
You are allowed as a speaker.
The sort of outline of this talk, I'm going to start off by sort of introducing inflation, why we should study it, and sort of what the objects of interest are. I'll then introduce the wave function of the universe as it's maybe a slightly non-typical way of studying correlation functions. I'll then go slightly away from sort of De Sitter and then look at sort of model building versus the bootstrap approach in flat space to then sort of justify the use of these bootstrap tools in the inflationary case. And then having set this up, I'll then be able to sort of discuss the fundamental principles that we need in the cosmological bootstrap. And in particular, I will be focusing on unitarity, as that's the main thing that I've been looking at. And that's where these cutting rules will come into play. What is inflation? So if we look at our universe, there is an initial period of approximately De Sitter expansion that we call inflation. During this phase, we have some quantum fluctuations in some very high energy system, which is of interest from a theoretical perspective, because we want to sort of learn more about what happens at high what the physics of our universe is at these high energies, and it's sort of impossible to recreate this anywhere terrestrially in any experiment that we can do. So it's this sort of like unique way that we can probe the universe. Unfortunately, we can't sort of stick any probe directly there. And what we rely on is at the end of this inflationary phase, there are some quantum fluctuations. And then over the course of the universe, they then grow into the sort of various things that we can see in the universe today. So for example, these perturbations become sort of galaxy clusters, or where there are lower density perturbations, we might get some voids today. Or we can also look at the cosmic microwave background, where we have some temperature fluctuations. And because we only have one universe, the way we sort of discuss the properties of the universe, of the observable universe today, is through correlation functions. So for example, we might look at the three-point galaxy number density, or some temperature correlation function, maybe the power spectrum. And these are the sort of observables we have access to today, and they trace some inflationary correlation functions. So we look at the three-point correlation function of the inflaton. Then by understanding these correlation functions today, we can learn about the physics during inflation and produce these perturbations. So the objects that we're going to have access to then are these correlation functions on this final time slice, which would be at time e to naught, which typically will be taken to be zero, although in some cases you have to sort of regulate some IR divergences by taking it to be some small but non-zero value. These endpoint correlation functions are then what we can study to learn about this high energy phase. However, instead of talking about these correlation functions, I instead will be looking at this way. So it turns out that these correlation functions don't have the sort of analytic structure that we'd like to study them. And so we look at the wave function universe instead. So this wave function universe is a path integral that is a functional of the field values and this final time. And it's equal to this path integral over the field values, where we take some initial condition, which will be throughout this talk a bunch of vacuum. This is an important factor in a lot of what I'll be talking about. I will try and raise it where it's key. And then at the end of inflation, it, at this e to naught time, it takes these values phi bar. And we integrate it over all these values of this phi. And the integrand is sort of standard e to the I reaction. And this wave function, if we'd understand it in sort of like this non-perturbative way, would be great, but instead what we have to do is discuss it perturbatively, which we do in terms of a sort of similar to a Taylor expansion, where we assume some, well, obviously this is a functional, and we assume some sort of analyticity properties of the exponent of this functional, I guess a logarithm of this functional, to then express it as a sum over sum from n equals 2 to infinity of what we call the wave function coefficients, which are some Fourier transform multiplied by these field values, each ka. Sorry, this will be a product here. Product over these a is equal to from 1 to n. This times what we call these wave function coefficients, psi n, and then we strip out a delta function which ensures translation invariance. And these wave function coefficients here are the objects that I'll be discussing. Because of a sort of holographic interpretation, these wave function coefficients can also be thought of as correlation functions, which leads to some slightly unfortunate terminology, in fact, that I have used in my title here, whereby both these wave function coefficients and these in-in correlators are both referred to as correlators. I will try to refer to these wave function coefficients exclusively, but if I do say correlators, I probably also mean these things, so I apologize.
But they are correlators. They are particle irreducible, right?
They are correlators, and they are correlators of these fields at the end of inflation, like on this final time slice.
Yeah, so I've always now lost it. But these wave function coefficients, these psi n, as you said, they can be answered as correlators, but it's perhaps unhelpful because we also refer to these as correlators. So I'll try and call them wave function coefficients.
So they depend on momenta as well.
Yeah, so these are now functions of all of the external momenta we have, plus potentially some internal momenta. Sometimes we'll need to be depend on the internal momenta as well. There'll be some number of variables that, depending on what n is, that we need to keep.
Sorry, what's the distinction between internal and external momenta?
So we calculate these with like Feynman diagrams. Any lines that go to the boundary are external momenta. Any lines that are inside are internal. So these internal momenta could also be expressed instead in terms of the external momenta and some angles.
But I thought that these are just wave function at the end of inflation. So I mean, this is part of what happened before.
So instead, you could think of it just as functions of like internal like the Fourier momenta. But it's typically easier to more helpful to understand them in terms of these energies. So these are rather than the momenta, these are the magnitudes of momenta.
These are magnitudes.
Yeah.
Are
these are magnitudes of like k1 plus k2. Yeah. So that's what these wave function these wave function coefficients will be. And the reasons why instead of using these correlation functions, we use these wave function coefficients is that, first of all, it will turn out that they have a nice analytic structure. So if we want to calculate these wave function, these correlation functions from the wave function coefficients, for example, if we wanted the this three-point correlation function, this is then equal to the real part of psi 3 divided by the product of the three energies at the real part of psi 2 at each of these ka. And similarly, we can construct arbitrarily high endpoint correlation functions from these wave function coefficients. And as you can see, they depend on these real parts. And so if we can make some statement about the analytic structure of these, it potentially be lost in the in these linear correlators. And similarly to this, another sort of suggestion that these wave function coefficients are perhaps nice objects to work with is that they can sort of be understood as the in-out object, whereas these are in-in objects. So in the same way that we study amplitudes in flat space, because they go from some initial state to some final state, these wave function coefficients similarly have this property that they start us in the vacuum and we end up on some sort of like stay with three fields in it. So those are kind of that's the reason why these. Hopefully, will become obvious later. But it turns out that these are nice objects to work with.
Yeah, can you explain why the real part survives?
The expression for some endpoint correlation function will be the path integral. Now there's no boundary conditions because we're integrating over all possible values of this, of these values on this final surface. Of the full wave function, phi bar e to naught magnitude squared. And so if we then plug back in that Taylor expansion, you'll find that, at higher order, you'll get some extra terms here, but just at this three-point function, which is the sort of simplest one, you end up with this this structure here. It's basically because this absolute value. For parity odd theories, it's actually not the real part. It then becomes the imaginary part, but this is just nicer to write down. So, So hopefully you're convinced that inflation is an interesting study, and this wave function of the universe is at least something, or these wave function coefficients are at least a way of studying it. Now we're going to discuss the approach that we're going to take to study it. Which is this bootstrap approach. So the historically sort of the initial way that we sort of looked at observables in quantum field theory was we started with some fundamental principles. And then from there, you can write down a model. And then we do some calculations to give us our observables. And perhaps the most famous example of this first step is GR, where Einstein started with the speed of light was constant. And then combine that with Lorentz invariance to get special relativity, and then the combination of that with the equivalence principle then gave GR. And we're talking about quantum observables here, so if we then accept that we can at least perturbatively quantize GR, we can then calculate some objects like the four-point function of a 2-to-2 scattering process, where these plus and minus indicate the helicities of each of these individual external particles. And so this is obviously going to work. We can do these calculations, but often they end up being quite complicated. So in this case that I've written down here, we're going to end up having some 500 diagrams we have to consider. Lots of those are related to each other by symmetry, but just to give the largest number I can, there's some 500 of them. And you have to calculate the diagram for each of them individually by performing some integral. And that can be somewhat tedious, especially as we get more and more complicated. So that's sort of the first, I guess, not necessarily a problem, but let's just say some, like, I mean, I'll use the word problem, but obviously it doesn't stop you from doing it. But these are sort of like some undesirable facts about this process. But the first is this difficulty. The final answer that you end up getting when you do this calculation turns out to be much more straightforward than sort of each of these individual diagrams would suggest. So it kind of gives us this idea that it's sort of this process is too difficult and we could maybe have done something more clever to sort of circumvent the problem. The second is that we need just a specific model. So in order to write down some observable, we need to know exactly what model we are in. We need to know what the interactions we're narrowing are to write down all these diagrams. What this does is, even in cases where we can sort of introduce some parameter that parameterizes a whole set of different models, we end up sort of with having to do this difficult process over and over again for each model we're interested in. And that sort of makes this process, the fact that it's difficult makes it sort of more a problem. In the case of GR, obviously, we can show that this is such a nice like unique model, so that's not such a problem. But within the inflationary context, we do want to be more speculative and sort of understand as many models as we can. The fact that we need to do these calculations for each of these models sort of then becomes somewhat undesirable. And the final thing, this is going to be slightly begging the question, is that because we've gone to this model and then done these calculations sort of one by one in this Feynman diagrammatic way, we've kind of obscured the link from these fundamental observables. The fundamental principles to the observables. So each of these individual calculations is not going, each individual diagrams is not going to satisfy the properties that we want the final answer to satisfy. But when we sum them all together, we then recover any properties that we want this object to satisfy. And I said this begging the question because that's exactly the solution that I'm going to propose, is to understand how these fundamental principles go straight to the observables, skipping out this model step. And this is what's known as the bootstrap. So to illustrate this, we're going to use the same example. The principles that we're going to use now are somewhat different. The only one that really stays here is this Lorentz invariance. Lorentz invariance tells us that whatever the final answer is going to be is a function of Lorentz invariant contractors of momenta only, and the only three that we have are the Mandelstam variables S, T, and U, and it's going to be a symmetric function of these by Bose symmetry. We also have this Little group scaling, which is a description of how if we're going in the direction of the of a particle, and then we rotate around it, we expect there to be some specific helicity scaling based on what the helicity of these external particles is. And we can most concisely represent this in the spin helicity formalism, where it turns out that the whatever the final answer is, it's got to be a Little group invariant term multiplying this particular scaling. Where these brackets are just some convenient notation that compactly expresses the scaling. And so whatever we have is going to be this multiplied by something that's a function of this STNU. Then we have dimension analysis. That tells us that whatever is multiplying this bracket structure is going to be some function that scales like 1 over the energy, 1 over the momentum to the 6th. And finally, we have locality. This is sometimes just referred to as analyticity. Which is a property that comes from some combination of unitarity, locality, causality, which tells us that we can have at worst, for a tree-level diagram, we can have at worst simple poles of these STNU. And so the only function that we can write down is then 1 over S times T times U, with some potentially some coupling constant there. But that can only be a constant. And this then is the only possible amplitude that we can write down at tree level that's consistent with all these properties that we want this final amplitude to hold, to have. And therefore, this is the answer for this 2-2 scattering process with this helicity configuration.
They didn't have unitarity here.
Unitarity, in some sense, like, so when I've described this as locality at some other talks, I've been told off and told this is actually a statement of unitarity. It's, and then that locality is actually going to come in at the next order in loops where you insist on some correlation functions decaying properly, which is why it's typically just called analyticity. But I've chosen because of the fact that it's describing some pole structure, and that'll be sort of similar to what we will see later. That's why locality is typically how it's described in literature, but it is also encodes something about unitarity. So yeah, like sort of not use unitarity, but sort of have.
Are you talking about the particle that's scattering here, or are you talking about this left hand side?
Oh, so this here is a flat space. So I'm just saying this is an approach that was used in flat space to calculate these quantum observables more quickly and easily. And then I'm going to sort of discuss the application of similar ideas to these wave function coefficients. Yeah, so this is your final this is the final answer. It's all that we can write down. And as I sort of alluded to before, this is much more straightforward than the Feynman diagrammatic calculation. I actually did this on the board. I did not write down 500 diagrams and calculate them for you. So we've sort of solved this difficulty problem. Because of the uniqueness of gravity, this sort of one model question, maybe you could dispute that, but sort of the statements about how long these properties sort of impose themselves on amplitudes is more general than just this GR statement, and we can use it to be more speculative. So we're able to look at multiple models sort of at once. And we've sort of, by construction, solved this problem here where we've said this is how each of these fundamental principles goes to our observables. So we've answered that problem as well, or addressed that conceptual challenge at least. The question is, so this is a very successful technique in amplitudes. And so the question then is, can we apply this to these wave function coefficients? And if so, what are the fundamental principles that we need in analogy to those that I've written down on the other board in order to find these wave function coefficients? So the first thing that we have, which is an observation that sort of like triggered the idea of looking into these kind of approaches is the amplitude limit. So if we take an interaction that happened in the infinite past within cosmology and insist that we are in this bunch of Davis vacuum, then because the fields are so deep inside the horizon, they don't see the expansion of the universe, and they don't see this horizon, they interact just as if they were in flat space, and then they propagate to the boundary as free particles. And we can recover this, we can, because our mode functions have some structure like e to the ik eta, where eta is conformal time, if we take the whatever the energy is in this exponent to be zero, and we sort of force this interaction to have only occurred in this infinite past, the only term here that contributes significantly will be when eta is minus infinity. And it turns out that when we perform the whatever the final time integral is of the bulk calculation, the correct energy that enters here, it's a total energy, which is equal to the sum over A of all of your external energies. And so if we take the limit of any wave function coefficient where kT goes to zero, this is going to be proportional to the equivalent flat space amplitude divided by the total energy to some power, where this power will depend on the dimension of the operator that we're interested in. And this is one place in which this cosmological bootstrap is sort of lacking compared to the amplitude bootstrap. We do still have to be mindful of what the interactions that we're allowing are, what sort of number of derivatives we're allowing. We're not going to be able to make such concise statements about these. This is the only allowed thing. We'll only be able to say, given a number of derivatives, we have these are the allowed things. So at this stage, that's all we're actually going to be able to say. But we're still able to be quite powerful within that sort of restriction.
It's not the same here. So here you also fix final initial states, right? You have only four states here.
Yeah. So this isn't about the final initial states. This is we still have to bear in mind some kind of Lagrangian interpretation of this expression here, because this P is going to depend on, for example, the number of fields and the number of derivatives acting on those fields.
It depends on the number of external legs.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, sure.
So why it's not the same?
Well, because I also have to say that I only have, for example, three time derivatives acting on the fields here. And if I then were asked what's the wave function coefficient if I had six time derivatives, I would get a different answer, even if I have the same number of fields.
Well, I think here as well, you also invoked dimensional analysis. Yeah?
Yeah.
Knowing that you don't have derivatives. Yeah, if you had derivatives, you would have other...
Yeah. I mean, I see this as being... This has some dynamical knowledge, whereas this is all sort of like kinematic.
Why it's not just how many why it's not n plus number of derivatives or something like why this p is not just controlled by n.
So this p can be independent. So if I had the interaction di phi cubed, this would contribute to a3 with p is equal to I think 3, and then if I also had d eta phi cubed. If I had like d eta phi cubed, this would contribute also to n is equal to 3, but now with p is equal to 6. So I've added more derivatives.
I see. So p depends on the interaction, not just on the external leg.
Yeah. P is also going to have some knowledge of this interaction. And so you need to have some knowledge of these interactions, which... That is just how it turns out the bootstrap is going to work in this cosmological setting, which maybe is expected. The dynamics is going to play a role.
This is not true on the right hand side. If I had different types of interaction, that there would
happen. It's not that So this is that if you asked for all of the different, if you wrote down just set, like all the different interactions that were consistent with these principles, it would all give you the same final answer. Because they would either be sort of related to each other by a field of definition or related to each other by integration by parts with some boundary term that would then vanish, and so on. So, but whereas in this case, these two terms could genuinely be different interactions. Any sort of three part of interaction that's going to contribute to this is going to be relatable to the ones that will give you just this term. By some.
Doesn't it depend on the dimension of the coupling constant? If you have like if it's a non-normalizable interaction, I have a dimensionful coupling constant, and depending on the dimension, I would have different powers of momentum.
I don't think so. I do think that this is a genuine way in which.
Only there
because mm-hmm.
the mention of the coupling constant changes, then the power there changes, so that you get that. Let's see.
Yeah. But anyway, so we do still need some knowledge of what these interactions are. We can't do these fully without the Lagrangian at all, at least at this stage. Second tool that we're going to use is we're going to insist on.
Because gravity is so constraining, yeah. So if we're considering scalar theory on this side, I could also have different universality classes. I could have lambda threatening,
yes.
Or I can have.
For a scalar field, yes, there are more things you can do. That is true. You're not so constrained as this for gravity, as you are for gravity. So, for example, in this case, if I was to ask for a spin 2 field, you still have this ambiguity. You can introduce operators for a spin 2 field that then contribute differently with these different p's.
Michael, what if you had
You add an R cubed term. It won't change. At this order, this interaction, it might give you some. This is the only thing that's consistent. As long as it satisfies these properties, this is the only thing that's consistent. So if you're still asking at tree level, it will turn out that that interaction generates, in perturbation theory, some term that is equivalent up to some coupling different coupling constant or theory definition, etc.
Able to build all the higher order correlation?
Yeah, so there's a procedure that will let you build, up.
So even if you include R cubed?
You should. So if you then include R cubed to the. When you're in this fat space example, you need to be a bit. When you're. The procedure to build up more complicated diagrams relies on. There's some contour integral that you do, and you need things to vanish at the boundary. So, depending on, at infinity, and so depending on what interaction you've added, you could potentially prevent this like recursive building up of more complicated diagrams. I don't know if that is the case with adding an RQ term to gravity. I don't know whether or not that is still possible. But if it is still allowed, if that term vanishes. Then you should be good in that case. And you should be able to ask what the different contributions are. But that, I don't know if that's true or not in that case. Next thing, sort of like similar to dimension analysis, we are going to restrict to a sort of pure order theta case, and we're going to insist on scale invariance. And what this does is it forces that all of the wave function coefficients scale as energy cubed. And the way that you can see this straightforwardly is in the exponential term, we had something that looked like integral of the product d through k of phi k times these wave function coefficients times delta 3 sum of k. I didn't mention the key fact. This is for a massless theory. So if we then restrict to massless fields, these phis all scale in such a way as to cancel this d3k, and so each of these psi n just has to cancel the scaling of this delta 3 in k, and so they will all scale like k cubed for massless particles. You can also make statements for particles of other mass, and you can restrict their scaling. It turns out that we're going to be able to say the most about massless particles, just as is the case in the amplitude bootstrap. Massless particles are the most constrained. We're going to insist on scale invariance, and in doing so, we've sort of restricted ourselves to massless fields. The next ingredient that we'd like to include is locality. Unfortunately, we don't yet have a full statement of bulk locality at the moment. But what we do have is what we call manifest locality. And manifest locality is a statement that at the level of our perturbations, there are no inverse Lipassians. Whilst this might seem like a decently robust statement of locality, it actually turns out that in theories involving gravity, where we have to solve some constraint equations, we can introduce these inverse Lipassians even in theories that at the level of the overall theory, they are unitary, but at the level of the perturbations, they end up having these inverse Lipassians. However, in particular in pure gravity, these inverse Lipassians only ever act on product of fields because the constraint equations are a scalar and a vector equation. So if you only have gravitons, they can only enter as at least quadratic terms. And what that ends up meaning is that even in the case of pure gravity, even though you have inverse Lipassians, this property of manifest locality is still going to hold. And the way that we implement this manifest locality is that we insist that this wave function coefficient satisfies the property that as we take any of the external momenta to be zero, the first derivative with respect to that momentum of this wave function coefficient is equal to zero. In higher dimensions, we also get some additional constraints on higher odd derivatives of this field.
Do we have a proof of that?
The proof of this comes from the bulk calculation. Because we're talking about massless fields, they're going to be constructed from some integral over some times, some product of these k's are what we call bulk to boundary propagators, and then also potentially some bulk to bulk propagators. This would be a diagram where we had. Each external line like this contributes to k, and each internal line contributes to g. Treating these k's and these s's as independent variables, as I sort of wrote earlier, this mode function has no linear term in k, and so if this is then true. And then if we just have more of them, this stays the case. So that's the proof, is just from looking at the bulk integral. And the reason why it requires this condition is if we then had some inverse Lipassian that just acted on one of these fields, we'd then get 1/k² term, which would then reintroduce the possibility of having linear terms in k. Yeah, perturbs. This is all to any order in perturbation theory. Okay, and then this isn't quite enough yet. For some case, so well, for scalar fields looking at a 3-point function, this actually is enough, and we can say what all the allowed 3-point functions are that are consistent. But if we want to go either to higher spins or to more complicated diagrams, we're going to need another constraint, and that constraint is unitarity.
Is it kind of sufficient also? I mean, do you have some kind of conditions for this locality?
I've been told that this is something I would like to look into more. Apparently, some Galilean theories that are non-local will end up satisfying this property, that they don't have these inverse Laplacians, but they'll end up being non-local in some sense. I'm not fully sure. The person that said that didn't really justify the claim that these Galilean theories were non-local. I would like to look into that more to understand if this is a necessary condition or sufficient. I'm not sure how this statement makes. A lot of people that I work with do claim that this is if this is satisfied, that it does have that. Any manifestly local theory will also be local, but I'm not fully convinced about that statement. But this is as good as we can do at the moment. When we are allowed to impose that, we end up actually being able to take some very strong statements. But obviously, a very important case of theories that have these inverse Laplacians is actually just if we look at scalar curvature in single field inflation, and you end up with a term that has this. So this restriction is actually much more important than just a statement I've made so far. It is a shame that this is the condition, because we have some interesting theories that we would like to be able to understand in this framework that don't satisfy this property. So going beyond manifestly local theories, I think, is very important, and it's something that I do want to look into more. It's just quite difficult to know where to start. And these Galilean theories are an idea that I have. So if people know anything more about Galileans, then it would be nice to talk about that. Unitarity. Sometimes unitarity can be used to mean some related but slightly distinct statements. I am really here just insisting that whatever our unitary time evolution operator is, it is a whatever our time evolution operator is, it is unitary. We insist on this condition for our time evolution operator, and by writing this u is equal to 1 plus delta u, we can follow the same steps that we use to get the optical theorem in flat space. This becomes a condition on this delta u. And then we sandwich this expression between two states. And the states we're going to choose are some n particle state on the left, where this is, this state here is some product of n creation operators acting on the vacuum. Then with delta u, and then with the vacuum state on the right-hand side, and then we're going to add the same n delta u dagger 0. And on the right-hand side, we have to insert some identity in the middle to sort of separate out these two things. I think I've written things too big, so I'm going to start a new line. We have some integral, some sum over all the allowed states, delta u some m, which I guess I don't need this integral because of how I've defined these. So this is just over all different m's, delta u dagger, and 0 on the right-hand side. So we can recognize this expression here as some wave function coefficient. However, unlike in the amplitude story, where I can take out this dagger here, and then interpret this just as the complex conjugate of some amplitude by crossing symmetry, these wave function coefficients don't have any crossing symmetry that we can use. And so what we then do is we interpret this in perturbation theory. And so the leading order thing that we can do is ask, if we have a contact term on this left-hand side, then on this right-hand side, it must vanish because this delta u is going to turn out, is going to start at linear order. And so this term is going to give us just the wave function coefficient, evaluate it with all of our energies. And then we have to add on, and again, I'm going to just keep these potential internal energies here. And then it turns out that this term here is the complex conjugate of these wave function coefficient evaluated at minus these energies complex conjugated. But the internal energies are kept the same. And these, you might question the fact that I've included this complex conjugate on these energies because they should be interpreted as real valued objects. But the reason why I have to do it in this way is that in order to regularize our integral, we have some integral where we go from infinity 1 plus I epsilon. And so where we've sort of rotated to the time to give us some initial Euclidean evolution in order to make it everything vanish. But seeing this in these wave function coefficients is not very obvious. And so instead of having this rotation in the time variable, we instead redefine all of our energies so that they so that all the energies go to k plus I epsilon, sorry, k minus I epsilon. And so this complex conjugate can be understood as ensuring that this minus I epsilon prescription stays the same for this this term here. So that's why you need to include it. Because if we just put this minus sign, we would change the sign of this I epsilon and then get some divergent integral. And then this right-hand side, as I said, is 0. But if we look at more complicated diagrams, instead of finding this right-hand side is 0, it turns out it separates into two diagrams. And we've done this calculation explicitly for the four-point function, but then we generalized it using methods more similar to looking at this proof of the NLT that I've written down here, where we looked at the bulk statement. But what we find is that if we have some diagram with some exchange line, where these circles sort of just indicate that there's some any sort of interactions can be happening here, we can then cut this line by looking at an object similar to this one here, where we analytically continue all the external momenta, as well as, because this was a contact diagram, there shouldn't be any of these S's. Right? But for this case, where we do have these again, the line that we're cutting, we don't analytically continue that line. That line just stays real. And we construct this combination of the wave function, its complex conjugate. And then the right-hand side is then equal to some product of simpler diagrams. But we then also have to do this same discontinuity operation here. So it's actually some analytic continuation of these terms. But if we can calculate these diagrams at lower order, which are more straightforward. Then we can build up these more complicated diagrams. This procedure of building these up is then enough to, once we've sort of said what the allowed three-point diagrams are, to then build up to four-point diagrams. And in theory beyond, although we've only done to four-point diagrams.
What are the diagrams? These are correlated, right?
Yeah, so this is some wave function coefficient. Yeah. And so this is like, if there's n fields here and m here, this is like m plus one external line, this is m plus one. And whatever interactions are happening here, they exchange just one momentum between them. So it's still, so this is just a tree-level diagram. That is a similar thing for loops, but just in this diagram, I'm only showing tree-level. We cut this line using this procedure where all we have to...
So this represents what? This term n, m, this matrix element? N delta u m, I mean the diagram.
This diagram would be the combination of this left-hand side.
But there is no
L. Oh, sorry. This is bad labeling, I guess. This is like N1, N2, where this is now like N1 plus N2. That makes sense? And then...
Okay, you basically split this n external legs in various ways.
Yeah, so you... you can just look at one diagram if it's just got one exchange line. For loops, you have to sum over all possible ways of splitting. But we can just look at one cut and then understand that diagram. And then if you wanted to build up the whole thing, you would have to look at all the different ways of cutting those lines. But just the relationship holds between just this single way of cutting. A single cut line. But you would want to look at all the different ways of cutting.
Okay, what do we do with the right-hand side?
The right-hand side then has some external... if this is S, we've now put S on this boundary. And without continuing S, you then construct this same object on the right-hand side, but it's the product of two lower-order diagrams.
With this?
So like I said, the proof of this we actually understand through the bulk calculation, or just for the four-point function, four-point exchange, you can expand out this term into the lower-order diagrams using perturbation theory. If you just write this in terms of the interaction Hamiltonian. And sort of relate between this expression here and these diagrams. So you just have to expand this in perturbation theory, and then you can interpret it as these same analytic continuations of terms. Yeah, but this construction then allows you to relate these higher point diagrams to lower point diagrams, which is sort of like the main takeaway is. Unitarity gives you this relationship in a very similar way to amplitudes. And this information, the fact that you have to reconstruct these three-point diagrams, as well as this manifest locality and scale invariance, is enough information to construct all the allowed four-point functions in a scalar field. And also, it's also enough information if we ask or what the four-point function in pure gravity is, to also construct that. I don't have a concise expression for that, but just because it takes about half a page and then a page of definitions, so there's no point in writing it out on the board. Showing it to you would probably be uninsightful, but this process of cutting these diagrams is enough. It gives you a more straightforward way of calculating this graviton four-point function, as well as scalar four-point functions, than the bulk method, where you have to solve for constraints, for example.
Pure gravity and de Sitter.
Yeah, pure gravity and de Sitter. So, in perturbation. Yeah. What was that? You can do loops. In loops, what you find is that if you wanted to ask, if you wanted to do the left-hand side, cut it in this way, you have to sum over all the allowed, all the possible allowed loops. So if we had this interaction, we would find that this was equal to 2 times this diagram, just because there are two different ways of constructing it by cutting lines, plus this diagram, where again, these diagrams involve these discontinuities as well. So there is like a... So whatever your diagram is here, if you sum over all the different ways of cutting that loop, you construct this the same discontinuity of this diagram on the left. And so it can build up. And so we've only managed to compute quite straightforward loops so far. But for example, the loop correction to the power spectrum we managed to find in this way. So yeah, that's I guess the end of the talk. But yeah, in principle, you can use this. We've just not like tried to do the
Can you construct the full? Can you construct the full one-loop correction to the graviton function coefficients, or only part of it?
It will give you if. It will give you like everything you're allowed to have, as long as you know all of the like lower point diagrams that you have. But yeah, you can get everything that you need. So I guess if you, but like I mean, so if you want to do that, for example, you would need to know the like 4-point contact, which comes about from solving the constraint equations. But you can do that in theory. Yeah, it's just not been explicitly calculated, but yeah, I don't know how complicated this would end up being, but it's just not yet been tried, so I can't tell you if there are some. It turns out there are actually some theoretical obstacles to it, but or some practical obstacles to the calculation.
How are we going to see non-normality?
You won't, because we're just building it like. So something when you find these loop corrections, they end up depending on these like divergent logs. The logs tend to only depend on H, so your scale factor. If you renormalize. So if you do dimreg where you also continue the dimension in the mode functions, it turns out that there's not this. So there's no divergence that ends up coming here from the energies. This is sort of a result that was known beforehand, but that we've shown again by looking at.
Okay, this log test won't contain any.
Yeah.
But in principle, the full thing you should see.
So I've never done it. I've not done these calculations. My understanding is that the ones that are done end up having these. So this gravity one, like maybe you end up seeing something. I don't know because I've not done it. But this is in the cases that I'm aware of where loop calculations have been done, they end up when you do this dimension regularization properly. In the sense that you continue also the dimension in the mode functions, you end up losing dependence, and so there's no divergence. It's the divergence is sort of at worst in the polynomial piece. So I'm not sure what you'd expect to see in this gravity case. I just don't know. I mean, this is the end of the talk, and I guess there's some. I've mentioned a few things that I would like to sort of progress with as we've gone. But yeah, the circularity problem, There's also a question of what we can say about the evolution of mixed states, because in that case, the density matrix, whilst the full density matrix is going to evolve in a unitary way, it's maybe not so clear if we look at the reduced density matrix that we're going to have this time evolution. And so in that case, maybe you actually don't get any of this information about unitarity, or it's obscured in some way. So I'd like to learn some more about that as well, as well as maybe look more into these group things. But at the moment, that's sort of a future thing. So thank you all for listening.
Is there a understanding of what are the shapes?
Yeah, so the sort of initially what we were hoping is that we could make some statement of unitarity where you then say, okay, this is what you should see observation in the sky, and if what you see differs from that, you can't then, like, we either have something beyond inflation or beyond single field inflation or beyond, or for some reason we break unitarity in whatever the theory is. However, as it turned out, when we actually went through the procedure of understanding how unitarity encodes itself, first of all, it's encoding itself in these wave function coefficients, not the correlators, which is not then directly observable, because if you wanted to reconstruct the whole wave function coefficient, we would need both the information of phi correlators as well as correlators involving complex conjugate of phi. Conjugate momentum of phi, which vanish. And so, because of that sort of difficulty, it just turns out that we don't have it. Just end up not being that sort of condition on something that could be observable. Hopefully, well, so we've come up with this list of these are the allowed shapes. So we have this varying this p parameter. You can say these are all the allowed sort of functions of k1, k2, k3 that you can get. But that's about as good as that we've been able to do. Maybe there's some other insight that would let you say something more directly observable. And this idea of looking into these density matrices also hopefully will lead us to some information about whether or not a state, if we can understand if a state is mixed or not by looking at actually observable objects. So we do have this idea, like, in mind, we're always trying to come up with things that are testable, but just so far it's not lined up with how unitarity does encode itself, which is just a shame, but it's how the physics seems to be. So.